If you look at agriculture, no, there are five, six elements which are fundamental. I mean, for centuries together, they are the same. It is only technologies probably would substitute those, in my opinion, fundamentally, right? Okay, the first one is you need soil, nothing else, right? And the second one is you probably need a seed. And third is you need nutrients. Fourth is you need something to protect. And the fifth is...
Fourth is you need something to?
Something to protect from the diseases, etc. Protect the crop. And next is your water. And the sixth one is the labor, right? I think these are the six elements that are constant, and technology is only either enhance, replace, do this on these core concepts, right?
I am excited to have Dr. Subbarao Garu. I'm using the term Garu here because it's a local way of endearment, and in terms of respect for people who've who've spent time in the trenches and working on complex problems. So Dr. Subbarao has spent about more than 30 years in agriculture, and of course I don't have to he needs no introduction for those who are working in the world of agribusiness. But so I really want to start off with maybe a sort of a question, maybe to go back to your past, Dr. Subbarao. Thank you, first of all, for joining us. How did your journey with agribusiness really begin? If you could really maybe go back to one of the earliest days as to what led you, what was like the decision point when you felt that, I really want to be in this kind of a domain?
Thanks, Venki. Pleasure to be with you today, this afternoon. Really appreciate me giving time to talk to you. Well, my journey started, just like any other individual, when you're studying, probably I was also a little bit aimless at that point of time, I can say that. When I was doing my undergraduate in agriculture, I thought that I will just move on to computer science, because that was in early 80s, that's when I did my undergraduation, right? Those are the days when we are using Fortran, COBOL, and the mainframes, using punch cards. That was it, right?
Yeah.
Then towards the end of my my graduation, in the final year, we used to have a very good professor who used to teach us genetics. That really made me think again. I mean, there is more fascination in genetics and plant breeding, I suppose, right? The reason is the way he told us genetics was not teaching on a board. When he really taught about as to how Mendel did his experimentation, I thought that, just using simple observations, there is a lot of interpretation that happened using your imagination, right? I think that's what excited me, the science. Then I said that, okay, computers, I do not know what is going to happen. And then I said that let me do a post-graduation in genetics and plant breeding. That's where I ended up there. And at the same time, that time I also read a book called Social Impact of Computers. I still acknowledge that book because just like what we see today, every single intervention that happens now in computer science, people think that jobs are going to go away. At that time, it was the same discussion that was going on, but this one individual wrote a book and said that is going to create more jobs. And exactly that's what happened, right? Yeah. Okay, despite whatever it is, I continued my education in science during post-graduation in genetics and plant breeding. Then after that, I was thinking, what should I do now? That was the first year when IIT introduced GATE as an exam for getting into M.Tech, right? Then I said that, okay, let me do biotech, right? That was exciting field at that point of time, obviously.
So this professor must have been in BHU, I suppose.
Yes, that was in BHU. And then I wrote the GATE exam. Then I could get through and joined IIT Kharagpur to do my M.Tech. But after maybe 2-3 weeks, I decided that why I'm doing master's again, let me do a PhD, because that's how I wanted to do science. I went all over the place, finally ended up in the University of Hyderabad and joined PhD. Well, I was trying to do molecular biology at that point of time in India. And in late 80s, doing molecular biology in India was not easy because you had to depend a lot on import of equipment, import of chemicals, which are highly perishable. And our regulations are so, so strict, I would say, in the right sense, that by the time you receive your chemicals, all the chemicals would perish. That is what the kind of situation that was in India in the late 80s to do PhD in molecular biology. But having said that, I continue on the PhD for the 4 years. And towards the end of it, I decided that, okay, maybe this is not the place that I have to be in. While all my colleagues, they left for the US, I decided to stay back in India and said that, okay, let me see what I can do. At that time, I was just walking by, driving by an organization. At that time, it used to be called ProAgro. I just happened to walk into that organization and then I said that, do I have a job? Then they said, okay, you come back after a week and then join us. That's what they said. I just joined that organization, to be very precise, right? Of a seed company in 1990. That was when I started my career. And then at that time, I was not too sure that what I was doing is the right thing. And then if you ask me very clearly, is it planned? It was not. But I think once I got into the business, I was more fascinated by being in agriculture. Let me put it that way. The reason is, at that time, what we have seen is, there are very few seed companies, first of all, in India at that time, right?
It was not so mature. 1990,
the ProAgro.
Yeah.
And then when I was traveling across India in many parts, including the seed production areas, it happens to be one of the founders of that company is also the global vice president at one point of time, one of the big multinational organizations. And then the stark difference between what was there in the US and compared to India is like phenomenally different. Look at the yields of corn, et cetera, right? Mm-hmm. And also when I was traveling, I saw lots of farmers who were like really struggling to get higher yields because of course the reference point for me was US yields at that time, like any naive person, it was like a so many tons there, and it was only 1/4 here. How the hell it is possible, right? Is there anything that we can do? I think slowly I just developed interest both professionally in that organization, learning, and as well as probably trying to see if there is anything that I can we can create some impact on the with the farmers. And I think throughout my career, the only defining thing that I had in my mind was, whenever I had to make tough decisions, I always put that in my friend. Is it going to benefit the farmer? Am I doing something which is good for the farmer? Then the company came rest. I can give lots of examples around it. Anyway, that's how I got into agriculture business, stepping into ProAgro. For 10 years, I worked there. And then after that, I moved to Pioneer. And then another rest of the 22 years, I worked there. Just two organizations, one in 10 years, another in 22 years. I started in between. I was in Belgium for 6 months. I think I was the person who actually did a work on transgenic mustard. Today, we are talking about the GM mustard in India, right? At that time, there used to be an organization in Belgium called Plant Genetic Systems, which actually commercialized GM mustard using Barnett Barster in Canada and canola. And canola and Brassica gentia, that is mustard, Indian mustard, has a half common genome, right? There's a common genome, 1/3 of the genome is common. I was trying to establish whether this particular events were on the same genome or not, to decide whether to do a transformation for new events or just use a back crossing. I think I did some molecular biology work coming from my PhD background and then decided that we go for back crossing. And that's why we developed GM mustard in 90s in India. Very few people know. There was one of the first people that we did the field trials here and then advanced it in that decade, right? And then that's where I started my career in research, and then moved on to what you call building a seed conditioning plant and managing some production, then moved into agronomist, and then product management, then to production, then to country head, then to regional heads. I think that's where I took my career in all functions, except the finance and the HR. I think all the mainstream functions I worked every 2-3 years. And then out of the 32 years, I was managing as a business head in one or the other form from 2004 onwards to 2022. That's about 16 plus to 18 years. Yeah, that's how my career was. Yeah.
Oh, quite a. I mean, I can see how much of a bottom-up journey in terms of from research and to come to almost at the very heights of leadership. I mean, what is very fascinating is, you know, at least in a common mainstream, there is a mindset that there is a, you know, when you do PhD, you are either suited for an academic role, and then to plunge into business is very few people do. I mean, even today, I talk about in how in agri life sciences, right? There are very few PhD founders who come back and become founders. Most of the PhDs are wanting to go abroad and you know, get into a nice comfortable position, and then, you know, there you're settled in some sense, right? So I'm curious why you you know, you didn't want to go into an academic path and sort of wanting to explore the business side.
Well, I think probably this is a little bit of a biased version. Let me start with saying that I was conflicted at that time, right? My passion was to do PhD and science. There's no doubt about it.
Okay.
In the sense, want to do postdoc, et cetera, et cetera. I think the 4 years that I spent doing PhD, there were too many constraints because of the infrastructure, regulations, and the preparedness, right? I think that was at the end, towards the end of it, I was probably a little bit more conflicted and saying that should I continue here with all the constraints, or do something else, right? And also probably sometimes, I mean, you just, as I said, if you recall correctly, you know, previously I was kind of wavering from one to another, right? A fickle-minded kind of a person, probably, to just see that, or to experiment something new. I do not know whatever it is the right thing. And then I said that, okay, I have done my PhD. Let me see if I can do some business, get into some job rather than continuing my as a postdoc, right, into academic. I don't think I got any, I had at that point of time anything specific in my mind as to why I made the decision. I probably, it was very impulsive decision, I would say.
Right? I see.
My attitude towards doing something new and experimentation, right? I think just happened to be like that.
No, let me rephrase this question in a slightly different way. Given your depth of, you know, research and with the PhD and all the work that you've done, how has it contributed for you at a business level, you know, on an everyday basis there? Has that really shifted? Because a lot of people in the industry are either, you know, they start off from the ground or they do into sales, and then from there they climb up the ladder there. But given that research, how has it given you a unique advantage when compared to others who probably come from a, you know, more from a field ground experience?
Okay, partly maybe the nature of industry that I was working on is seed business for years together, and also crop protection for a while. In both of these areas, no, at the end of the day, the most important thing is there is a huge amount of infusion of technologies, right? Mm-hmm. If you look at whether it is a breeding technology, molecular breeding, biotech, anything that you see, there is always an infusion of new technologies. That is number one. And then the understanding of that, right? Whether it is a plant breeding, I appreciate the complexity of product development probably as a business person help is much more than many people who come from sales, right? Complain about salespeople.
Yeah,
and then sales want yesterday, but coming from the science background, I always could appreciate the complexity, the time that is involved, and the uncertainties of product development, right? actually, that helped me in the business. I think as a, the company that I ran is known for a few things which are very differentiators and also created the competitive advantage. One of them has been is that it's one of the company is the best in launching new products, launching new products at periodical intervals. And the brand image is around new products and good products. I think if you look at now, the appreciation and the intensity that is needed around this whole product launch starts with the product development. And I had that appreciation of that first of all. And coincidentally, during my career, I also got to travel across India as one role that I handed, which is the agronomist role, which actually brought the market needs perspective, right? I think I could translate well the market needs into product development, the people who are developing. So as an example, if I remember correctly, in one instance, for any market segment, you will have some attributes that are needed in the product, right? And there used to be 10. I cut down to 4, right? Just because I knew what is the 4 important. When it is 10, I believe that it is more confusing for people who are defining the market. And it becomes very complex for the people who are developing the product also. But every trait, it just takes so much time. So if you look at that whole science thinking and then little bit of analytical thinking, I actually applied on my job, which is helping the research as well as ability to translate the market needs into product development and also put a process in place of how do you take the products into the market using marketing strategies also, right? I think the learnings on my job were coupled with my science background together helped me to drive the organization, which built a competitive advantage. I think I used all my experience to actually translate into business.
And that's where I'm also wanting to look at it. You know, one of the reasons why I was very fascinated to talk to you was, you know, you have a long vantage point of time to look at things evolving, right? So maybe that's where the next question is want to explore in terms of in your 30 years of how you've been in the industry, what's the most significant transformation that you think has happened in this industry per se?
Well, let me start by saying two things and then I will elaborate, right?
Sure.
So firstly, no, I wish I could go back 30 years once again. The reason I am saying that along my career, now every decade, I saw something which in retrospect, I said that why I did not see this, right? Coming. That means to put it simply, in every decade, there was a big transformation in the area that I worked in, right? When I say that, no, the first one is 80s, if you look at probably 90s, if you look at in India, where I spent most of my time, people were, let me take corn as an example to be very precise, right?
Sure.
And then corn used to be only about 5 to 6 million hectares and with hardly 20% hybrids. Okay, the technology penetration is less than 20% at that acreage. And today's acreage of, let's say, anywhere between 10 and about on an average of 10 million hectares, it is 20, right?
Yeah.
And so it is so small penetration of the technology into the acres, right? So the transformation, if you look at those 80 in the 90s, where you take any hybrids, right? That is when you see a lot of growth that happened in corn, rice marginally, I would say, millet, all these crops that have really penetrated, right? And then if you look at this, that is, I'm coming from the technology point of view, then I'll also cover other areas.
Sure.
The next decade, if you look at 2010, 2000 to 2010, it's the you got the BT cotton, you got hybrid rice. So two areas, if you look at now, one is you have got new hybridization technologies into crops which were not there, and as well as the biotech as a piece, right, which kind of penetrated quite number of acres. And then if you look at the third, the 2010 to 2020, then again you have got hybrid mustard, right, and hybrid vegetables. Lots of vegetables were introduced. So if you look at just from a technology perspective, every decade there is a transformation that is coming from that point of view.
And it slowly moved towards horticulture also.
So fundamentally what I'm trying to say, you know, just taking India as an example, which is a surrogate to an extent, I would say, for some of the countries, is like really the value on the acres have gone up significantly in the last three decades, right? The economic value for the business is yes, but at the same time, unless this value is really translated to the farmers, no technology will penetrate and the businesses grow at the pace that it happened, right? Likewise, if you look at crop protection chemistry, today the chemistry that is available, the active ingredients that are used at 1/100th of what used earlier, right, or 1/150th, 1/100, and then they are much more safer. And these also, every decade, there are new molecules that are coming, which are more safer, more environmentally friendly. So the technology penetration is there, first of all. Likewise, if you look at the fertilizers, the nutrients, right? The way nutrients were used in the last, as compared to the last, the previous decades of 1990 and 2000 to 2010 versus post-2010, more complex fertilizers, more more understanding of the nutrient needs. There are more to do, obviously, but even in the nutrient space also it is there. And the best part is mechanization, right? I mean, when I first looked at rice harvesters, I thought that somebody has gone crazy in this country to introduce, to even build and sell a harvester in rice, right? I think, I mean, it is totally unimaginable in thinking that how can a small farm can get into a mechanization with the harvester. And if you look at today, I mean, in the state that I live in and you are here, every acre almost is harvested through combines, right? And mechanization also penetrated. So if you look at several technologies in every space have penetrated decade by decade onto the farm. That is number one. And the second one is really the access to markets, the access of the farmers to the input, to the goods and services. I think that also has gone tremendous transformation. When I say transformation, two areas I would put it, right? One is the penetration of rural distribution has gone up significantly on what was in 1990s, right? And I don't know the numbers today in terms of the retailers. There must be a few lakhs, I think, right? The last number is some in actually thousands and thousands.
I mean, it was early, at least with the in 2016-17, there were almost more than 2 lakh retailers. And now that must have easily increased more than there.
As an example, UP is the place that I take as an example.
Okay.
I mean, there was hardly a rural distribution of ag inputs was not so high. And today, if you go, you can find retail points everywhere. And likewise, in many of the states, you see the same change. And likewise, the influence of the distributor on the business has also reduced over a period of time, right? And then the
very interesting. Okay.
And the third element is the farmer access, the farmer, the connection between the farmer and the company has also changed over a period of time, right? In the 1990s, very few people or if any company would hardly touch farmer, right? Doing field activities, touching the farmer, creasing as a center of attention. That does not exist. But over a period of time, these things have changed. So the way you go to the market has changed significantly. both by the push as well as the pull from the market, I suppose, right?
So those are the
changes that happened over these decades, technology-wise, distribution-wise, and access to farmers-wise, and of course, the I would say, first of all, acknowledge the farmers for their acceptance to better value inputs, right? Better value to access technology. I think that is always I give biggest credit to the farmers in India rather than anybody else, because you always listen from people saying that okay, whether farmers can afford, when the farmers can buy, will they buy? Do they have the risk bearing capability? I think all these things that I have seen with my own hands, with my own eyes, that they are the people who would provided. You give them value, right? I think it's as simple as that.
Yeah, but I want to maybe push back this point a little bit, because I want to explore a few questions in this side a little more interestingly. Because what you're saying in terms of access to market is very interesting, right? While I also am able to relate to what you're saying in terms of the distributor's influence has come down. But at one level, one of the things that really strikes me very fascinating in this industry is that the market dynamics has also been very constant in many ways, right? In terms of the role of channel per se, right? While it might have, like you said, while it might have shifted in terms of the role of the distributor, but we still have a sense where, you know, I mean, I remember this conversation when Pran from Sumitomo had posted in public also, in where he had talked about this, you know, there's a whole idea of pump and dump things happening in the season, in the channels. And also there is almost a certain sense of push is dominating the pull. Right. If you really place them on a two sort of, you know, between, of course, the various constraints and all that. But largely, if you place them in one single place, the push seems to dominate the pull. I'm curious, how do you see that? You know, do you see that while there has definitely been a shift in the access of market, do you think that the market dynamics have really changed? Or I'm just curious to look at this point.
So first of all, it is a perspective from a reference point, right?
Correct.
So I come with the reference point of 1990s because
I'm just saying at a broader level.
Yeah.
The market
what is there
to
from
not
there
changed.
It is shifted. Yeah. From what was then in 1990 to 2020, right? There is a shift in some of the things that I said, right? It is all related from what point of view. There's a shift. There's not probably a transformation, right? These are two different things. Mm. It's still a shift. But it did not transform to the extent that it has to be. So having said that thing, now one of the things that I just wanted to reiterate is,
sure,
whether you take the US markets, advanced markets, any other markets, there is still a farmer believes somebody, he has a trust on somebody to purchase, right? For making a purchase decision, he needs to have a trust on somebody. Right? Like probably you and me also, it may not be as obvious as it is in that
case.
But still we have some kind of a trust. You are believing somebody to make a purchase decision, right? Whether it is advertisement, TV, or you, me, or your friend, your colleague, your salesperson, whatever.
It's also because the risk is also more on the other person also.
Exactly. Another thing is, you and I know that farmers, I think the risk is very high, especially in certain goods. If you don't make the right decision, I think you are done for the year, right? So that also becomes a little bit more riskier also. Having said all those things, now the trust factor becomes very important. So when I looked at that now, even today back in the US, the retailers are significantly influential on the farmers, right? That is why that chain did not also break.
Correct.
It continues to be probably a different format. Enough influence is there.
Correct.
So anyway,
it takes a new shape. Yeah.
New shape. Right, but the retail did not vanish, right?
Correct.
So from that point of view, I think the reason I quoted that example is to just bring to some conversation wherein we say that probably we have to live with the shifts at this time before we get into transformation, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And now having said that, the influence, the push and pull part, I think the next part of the question is the push and pull part, right? See, again, it is the... I would call your strategy of the business drives push and pull. Because I am very extremely biased in what I am going to say, obviously, but there may not be not many people agree with me, but that's okay, right? See, we ran an organization which is very pull-driven.
I see.
Okay, that is very obvious. Everybody knows in the world. The only reason is it is a conscious strategy of the business which is executed so that your business is driven more by pull rather than push. Having said that, the dependence on the distribution system of India is important, and we value it, and we continue to value it, right?
Correct.
It doesn't mean that that one thing you said, no, just dumping will push sales. I am not a believer in this world. Probably in 1990s, I would have. I think today's markets have changed.
Interesting.
The competition has changed. People are working differently. And if you really want to drive a business on a product and value, then I don't think you have an option except pull. But if you want to drive a business in undifferentiated, distribution dependent, then push is the right strategy. So it depends upon what you're dealing with, right? I don't think there is a one answer for everything here. And both are important, and you need to make your choice what is the right way to go into the market, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's where, you know, it's very interesting the point you mentioned on shift to transformation, right? Because at one level, I think, well, definitely, you know, the more ideal scenario would be where directly the businesses interface with farmers. But and we are seeing there's also multiple dimensions, of course, that's are playing out in this, right? Like, for instance, one of the things that's coming on top of my mind is as the farmers' behaviors are shifting from, you know, as the there is a certain slightly more better growing acceptance of, say, biological products in the market, right? There is also a certain shift in the channel behavior, right? Yep. So we are seeing that also right now in the market, right? Where you see that now with there is more acceptance for, say, FPO-driven purchasing, right? And then there is also, because that these products have need you to have a better understanding of agronomy in terms of which cycle to use and all of them, especially for biologicals. There is also an increasing shift on needing us, like you said, the trust ecosystem to be slightly more technically understanding, right? So how do you see this shift there? There are two parts to it. One is like in terms of as the products are also shifting in, do you see any shift happening? And the second is in your perspective, how do you define the transformation? Like when you talk about the shift to transformation.
Okay, let me start with the thing again, with the product shift that you already talked about and the transactional shift, right? And then see what transformation looks like.
Yeah.
Okay, transformation from my perspective, I'm going to talk in a with a narrow sense of as to how a business is done with the farmer. Okay.
Sure.
Okay, that's what my definition of transformation is. And now, as you rightly said, now the product category that is coming in, which is whatever it is driven by various aspects, as you know that, right? Whether it's the regulatory issues, environmental reasons, or sustainability reasons. And all these, probably these products would definitely need what I call a value selling, right? A value selling demands a lot of personal communication or digital communication, but wherein you need to be able to reach out and explain as to what is this new product is going to provide as a benefit to you. The reason is, no, just take one example. If you look at a choice for the farmer to apply between a biologicals and a non-biological product to control something, a pest or a disease, or to enhance his nutritional requirement, right? One is the cost, the other is the benefit, right? So now when you're coming with these new products, if you want to sell the value, it is going not going to be an easy task, right?
Correct.
First of all, it is not going to be a solution that is like a like what you see with your earlier products in terms of its performance. Mm. Right?
There's slightly more uncertainty about the performance also.
Yeah, because it is not like today you do something and then tomorrow you see the result type, right? When you're selling these new concepts, it probably needs beyond just what your experience had been, as also and also education to train as to how to use them and what is the benefits beyond just the control, the sustainability. We say these are the concept selling, right? The concept selling, value selling, this is the shift that is happening, right? And then with this, can you drive this through a push system? Absolutely, without any pull? I don't know whether it is going to be an easy task, right?
Okay.
A push will happen once you create some element, some threshold level of pull. In order to do that, still you are doing pull. So long story cut short, your new products, concept sellings, you are forced to do more of, they're forced to do more of pull.
Correct.
Right? There is this period. I don't think there is any other shortcut.
Sure.
And then coming back to the second question in terms of the shift and the transformation and the transaction with the farmer, right?
Mm.
I think we talked about a while ago as to the trust of the farmers, and the trust of the farmers lies with the retailers. I think you do any survey, it is just the answer is the same, right?
Correct.
And then why he is the retailer, there are many elements into it, right? We cannot go on arguing about it, the whether it is a correct thing or not, it doesn't matter.
It is a fact.
The current situation that you are in, it is a fact of the matter, it is what it is, you need to accept it. The social structures, the regulatory structures, etc., whatever it is, right? And then if the trust is there, he is going to transact with the retailer as the person, right?
Yeah.
And he is the most important element. That's why they said that the influence, this kind of move from retailer to distributor to retail for a business, is because partly this also, and also the ability to reach retailers by the businesses have increased tremendously, unlike in the past, correct?
Mm.
You are able to reach them. Earlier, you had no visibility who the retailer was beyond the distributor. And your infrastructure was not so easy to even reach them, to travel, to go and meet. And communication was not there. I think there are multiple constraints, which are infrastructure constraints, because of which you are not able to reach. And the second point is, now you're able to reach there, now you're able to reach the farmer. In the second piece that you want, if you want to close a transaction with anybody, you need to be able to deliver the goods and transfer money. I think those are these things, right? So delivering of goods, logistically, what is cost effective? Can a company today cost effectively deliver it as compared to a retailer, right? Your cost of delivering the goods becomes a little bit expensive or difficult to manage.
Yeah, and the cost doesn't seem to be going down also further. Yeah.
Correct. And the next one is the transaction, money transaction.
Correct.
And if you look at even 10 years back, there is no way you could transact digitally, right? And today, it has tremendously transformed.
Yeah.
Digital transactions.
Yeah, even farmers are making UPI transactions.
UPI transfers, right? And now, just to summarize, the infrastructure constraints, the financial transaction constraints, logistic constraints, I think these are the three fundamental factors where what it used to be 90s has changed significantly. That is where the shift is happening.
Mm.
So now what the transformation looks like for me is the day I go and see the farmer, I talk to him, and I close my transaction, and I deliver my goods. I think that's where, when I can deliver the goods, then I can today transact, assuming that I will also be able to provide a finance for him then and there, if he's not ready with the money. And if we're able to close that, and these things can happen, then I would say there's a transformation happened in this country.
Okay.
Right? Okay, let's see where we go there. I mean, so probably this is okay. We can do probably with some big farmers even today also.
Yeah.
To an extent. Whether that can be done effectively, somebody can crack this whole model, is something to watch, is something to follow, something to innovate, right?
Yeah, but and right now, that's what the interim, what is happening right now is, this largely ties with what I'm seeing in agritech, right? Where a lot of online marketplace players have, either they call them online marketplace players or whatever you want to call them, right? They are becoming digital distributors.
Correct.
Right? That is also another shift that is happening, where there is a digital distributor who is coming in and saying, I will probably compete with you with all the distributors' terms, but of course I will give you the benefits in terms of the digital aspect, where you have a captive audience, you know, and there is a certain percentage of conversion and all of that. So how do you see that? Do you think a distributor with an app can coexist very well with distributors? How do you see that part of the shift per se?
Well, the thing is, the point here is that definitely there will be a change for sure, right? Okay, let me start by saying that no, because I probably will speak more in the financial terms always.
Sure, just to make it clear. Sure.
There is a value between the company,
okay,
between the farmer, what he pays, and what the company input suppliers,
correct,
the distribution, there is some money in between, which is the correct value of that whole area,
correct.
Okay, now anybody who is innovating in this space, right, if only you are trying to redistribute the current that is shared, let me say that, to give a simple example, if there are 3 points or 2 points in the distribution chain between the farmer and the company, let us say a distributor and a retailer and a retailer, two retailers, and if it distributed, let's say in certain percentage among these three, and you as a digital innovator, what are you trying to do? Are you trying to only take a value from one of these? You have to be very clear, right? Yeah, and why you are taking this.
Right now most of them are seem to be taking away the wholesaler's share. Because they are directly kind of interfacing the company with the retailers and coming in between as a captive marketplace, where whatever your products are, I can sell it to these bunch of retailers I have, and these retailers are the ones who are using my app, and they often provide inventory also, right?
Correct. So now you need to understand, why do you think that you can replace a distributor? What are the 2-3 critical elements that a distributor provides? Are you able to provide that substitution?
Okay.
Correct? Literally, yeah. I'm going to the extreme side of it now.
Yeah.
Can you substitute a distributor with what you are planning to do? I think distributor provides certain key value additions in this whole supply chain, right? Whether it is a credit, whether it is a logistics, right? Whether it is a downstream distribution. I think definitely there are some areas that is going to provide a value. So if you really wanted to completely replace, then you need to be able to provide all the services that a distributor is providing today when you want to connect directly with the farmer, correct? Directly with the retailer. And I do not know if the people are completely prepared to do that on a scale across India. That is number one, right? And in the absence of that, then what is the one or two elements that you are trying to do that a distributor is not trying to do today? Correct? At least that part you need to fulfill.
Correct. I see where you're going.
And then one, as long as you are clear about these things, then the, what do you call, the coexistence comes, right? Where the distributor would like to work with one more digital player, as long as you are taking part of his pain and also trying to substitute the one that he is doing today in a different way. Just to take an example, no? Let's suppose today he is locking up some money as an example, right? Because either he is providing a credit to the distributor or giving some advances to the company, or if the company also he takes some credit, but he has to kind of pay the money in certain time, etc., etc., right? Whatever it is, there is an element of what do you call, the cash, the money component there, which is a cost to the distributor. You as a partner to distributor, right? When you are connecting some input company, are you going to take some of this pain and take it? Are you going to provide him some more value addition for him?
Then and that value addition, you are defining it, and the value addition you are defining in terms of better credit and availability there?
Correct. In a way, yes. Let me put it that way, right? Or you are going to provide him a logistical support? Are you going to provide him an inventory management? Are you going to provide him in some XYZ? I do not know what it is, right? I think as long as that is clear, then the coexistence is something which will be very, workable. So,
okay.
Just to go back to your question, I probably took a long route to say that your question was whether distributor will adopt some of the new marketplaces. It will be a part of it. I do not know today is in a misery to work with, as long as you are disturbing him what he is doing, right? Disturbance is only that you are trying to create, bypass a channel of distribution, and you are becoming as a distributor, right? And connect to the retailer. That's our intention is.
Correct.
But will you be able to service the same level? Do you have the depth? Can you do it? That is the fundamental question, right? Otherwise, companies would be very happy to do it. No company would actually work with distributors, but nobody is jumping onto the marketplaces so aggressively because they know the limitations, right?
No, but it's a very fair point.
The logistics part, the inventories, the ability to push. One of the things, if you really need a push strategy, will marketplaces act as drivers of push? Not know.
I see your point.
That has to happen, right?
No, it's a very fascinating answer that you gave. I think, which ties back to our earlier question that we talked about, right? Like, for instance,
I am not kind of pessimistic. I am very optimistic of things. Things will evolve. Things will go. Things will coexist. But they are not going to be called binary tomorrow.
I understand, and I think you are setting the term for how things will really, you know, how to push the bar forward. So I think I take it in that way, because there are a lot of founders and entrepreneurs who are listening to this. I'm sure will be able to appreciate the point that you're making in terms of what is it that we need to further push the boundary of value that I'm creating as a distributor, as a digital distributor, probably.
Right.
But I also want to maybe touch back on the companies that you worked with in the past, right? And their strategic approaches, right? We know that among the big six agri input companies, each of them have their own set of strengths. I mean, the space has been shrinking down in some sense, right? We only have six people at least at this point where we talk about, of course, there are other set of players, but largely for the bigger players, there's been a lot of consolidation. I'm sure you're familiar with all of this, right? So in that kind of a consolidated environmental space, I see almost like a two different trajectories, right? In my analysis, and I've written about it in my newsletters and in a greater depth there, right? There are at one level, there are customer-centric companies, which are largely taking a slightly more, if I can use the word, progressive stance, where they're partnering with multiple marketplaces and also creating marketplace ecosystem approaches, where they are collaborating with different stakeholders, you know, be it agritech startups or be it other farm partners, and then they proceed. Right, that is one kind of players in this ecosystem. other kind of players are slightly more product focused, which is like, look, you do whatever you want, I'll focus on my product. I mean, this is my reading, okay, of course. They may not necessarily agree with this, but in my reading, I see them having a very strict product focus per se. Right? And I'm curious, why do you think this kind of focus is needed in this kind of space, especially if the, given the market is also evolving?
Well, see, if you look at the approaches by the companies, of course, there's a lot of consolidation that happened over a period of time, especially in the last few years. Anyway, this is very cyclic, this consolidation, yeah, and deconsolidation business. But whatever it is, at the end of the day, there is a level of consolidation that happened for sure,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. And right then, now, we don't see any deconsolidation happening though, yeah.
Whatever it is, at the end of the day, I think every company was built around a core competency. That's what I would put it, right? And there are strong beliefs on the successes that they had. And then try to retain the core, first of all, correct? Before you jump into something which is market-driven change that one has to adopt, right? Mm. So some of the core things remain core despite the changes that happen in the industry or in the marketplace or in the technological space. So the core is now. I think I was also reading somewhere, despite we can talk of a lot of technology and all, which is very important. Even AI, ChatGPT, or generative AI, anything that you bring in, at the end of the day, one sentence that's always written is, you need to understand, you need to see what is relevant, you need to adopt quickly, but on the core areas, you may not want to change anything, your customer relationships, your connection with the personal touch with the customer, personal touch with the employees. I think there are some core areas, right?
Correct.
That's what they call them, the core areas.
Yeah. Fundamentals don't change.
Fundamentals don't change, right? Yeah. So on the core areas, I think some companies had this by nature that they evolved and saw the success, right?
Mm.
One set of companies saw a tremendous impact of the technology that has come in. Right? And then they believe that if you have got the right technology, which is more new and more transformative and more value creating, I think that is going to drive the business growth, which is simple and straightforward. I think no drama in it, right?
Right, yeah.
And that is one belief of one set of companies. Another set of companies are in the core, they say that, okay, I am going to excel on another area where very strong customer relationships, stay with the farmers, more, see how we can service them. And then anything built around them, whether it is digital, non-digital, service-oriented or product-oriented, etc., there's another approach, right? So if you look at, you see that cultural visibility coming out from these organizations very clearly in everything that they do.
Yeah.
The way they talk on the markets, the way they invest, and the way they behave. I think this is very clear.
Yeah.
And that's why you probably see those. Having said those things, both the companies do work on either side, right? The companies who are very strong on one belief, they continue to invest into digital space in areas where they believe in. Probably the product development, probably in the farmer solutions, right? Another company, does the same thing in rapid transformation technologies, where they say that, okay, out of 10, something is going to work, and let me invest and take the risk, right? I think it's just the approach, I would say, right? At the end of the day, at least in the three decades that I have seen now, technologies, when they come, and then somebody is going to win. And also, because of the nature of the business that we're in, agriculture now, any transformative technology that gets automatically licensed, right? The reason is these are very long-term, high investment technologies, first of all, right? And then also the access to acres is not possible by one company, however big you are.
Isn't it? The time it takes to for an active ingredient to come, newer active ingredient to come in the industry has elongated, and the risk has increased for the time.
Increased, and the cost has increased, and uncertainties are there, and all these things. No, they kind of enable. At the end of the day, the most important thing as an individual for me is whether the technologies that are coming in, whether they are available for large number of farmers across the world, right? That is what it is important. And the companies, their approach, what they are taking, today it is what it is at the end of the day, because of the consolidation that they are kind of focused on certain areas. But having said all those things, I am a strong believer in one thing, right? Whether it you take of the any industry, ag, non-ag, even if you take the IT industry, right, which is the most talked about, the big company never stays big in terms of the technology power. Okay, I think it's very important to understand this. Okay, if the big company can stay big, there's no reason for them to acquire anything in the world from a technology perspective. But you see that all big companies continuously acquire companies. Because you have got a money power, you're doing it. You have got a market access power, you're doing it. But technologically, probably they are not superior. Correct?
Yeah.
Okay. This is, you see, across the industries.
Yeah. And I think that's also the, sort of the race to stay relevant over time.
Yes, race to stay relevant.
Yeah.
So, from that point of view, if you look at, although we talk about these big companies, about what they're doing and closely following up and get biased, but my fundamental belief is that there is a lot of space for people in this world to innovate, and then that innovation always has a place to kind of go and get on, right? I think that's why what big companies do is only an element of more towards commercial bias, sometimes I would say, right?
Yeah. Commercial bias. Yeah, I understand. And I think, this is what is again another interesting aspect, right? Like you've started almost a year back, Flow Lab Ventures. And I think which is also into investing. So I'm curious, what was the idea, genesis behind moving into investing? Because at one level, I'm very happy because there are more people who understand the depth of the industry and coming into investors, right? Because that's great news for all the agri-tech entrepreneurs and founders, because they are oftentimes they face investors who don't understand the industry, and they get into a lot of, they suffer because of it, right? So what has been your, sort of genesis behind that led you to start to this kind of a venture?
Well, it's pretty simple and straightforward, nothing complex, honestly speaking. So as you come out of your professional career, right, you want to do something, obviously. One of the things is, I'm sure that I was kind of a little bit, I would say that I was sure that somebody is going to come to me for advice, right? As an advisor, let me put it that way. And obvious choice is lots of people would come to me in seed business or chemistry business. That is no brainer. But I must say that for the first 1 year, now it is about 1 year, 5 or 4 months that, since I retired. For the first 1 year, I never took up any job in the profession that I was in, any advisory position. Okay. And also now also I'm very choosy on that. I really wanted to go into a space within ag, for sure. And my interest is more towards the downstream side of ag. Okay, downstream is like the production agriculture side, right?
Okay, yeah, that's I call it upstream. I call it upstream, but yeah, I understand what you're saying.
Upstream. It's called upstream here. On the upstream side of the agriculture, which is the production side, right? And the downstream side, I was not very interested. Only reason being, it is very, I would say that somewhere the money, lots of investors are there, lots of money flows on that side, right? That you can see that. But I see that it is less technologically challenging and contributes less to production, agriculture, and the production as a whole, right? It contributes more towards the other side of it. So I'm very biased towards working in space where there is something contributing to the production of food, production, sustainability of agriculture, etc., etc. So my bias is towards this, first of all.
I understand. Okay.
Yeah. And then, as an advisor, I said that, okay, I mean, I can go and free advice. Then I said that, okay, I would be more happy if I got a skin in the game also in that, right?
Yeah.
Then I probably what I do, I'll be more engaged and be more, more contributing, right? And then it's not that I take money and then get away types, right? I think that's the reason I start investing into this, into the companies which I like to work with. Even though it's small investments, I also take a stake in that, so that I believe in it, I work on it. Of course, the risks are there. At the end of the day, that is a different aspect. But at least I have a belief, and I contribute towards the success of the organization. Right? I think that is what. That's why I floated Flow Labs Venture as an investment firm, wherein I go and selectively.
But it comes with your advisory and
invest, right?
Yeah.
So I said that over a period of time, I do not. I will take some other spaces also where I am not directly involved. But for sure, production agriculture, which is on the upstream side, is something which is my important thing, right? And in those spaces, also it is very clear. Let me put it this way, right? I think if you look at agriculture, now there are 5-6 elements which are fundamental. I mean, for centuries together, they are the same. It is only technologies probably would substitute those, in my opinion, fundamentally, right? Okay, the first one is you need soil, nothing else, right? And the second one is you probably need a seed. And third is you need nutrients. Fourth is you need something to protect. And the fifth is...
Fourth is you need something to...
Something to protect from the diseases, etc. Protect the crop. And next is your water. And the sixth one is the labor, right? I think these are the six elements that are constant, and technology is only either enhance, replace, do this on these core concepts, right? They're simple as that, in my opinion.
Very interesting. I think I'm also maybe interested to delve a little bit more on that part, right? I mean, I know we almost at the end of the session, but you know, it's like what very fascinates me in this, that like, you know, sometime back I was reading this B.R. Ambedkar's paper on Indian agriculture. He had somebody had commissioned him to do a paper on Indian agriculture, and what he wrote in 1918 sadly, you know, still sounds like a 2023 policy paper. In terms of the challenges, the problems, you know, the kind of aspects that we today talk about, right? Today, all so many op-ed come, and I also keep writing about all of these things. And it almost seems like at one level, well, there is technology has keeps shifting, and like you say, the fundamentals here, that the problems are also, in a sense, very perennial in some sense, right? We keep still talking about credit for almost like what God knows so many years. Right, we keep talking about it, and we're saying that the cost of credit has to go down. But I'm just wondering, is there a delusion in our minds where we are not wanting to see certain parts of reality and continuously increase a problem, or is the problem perpetuating itself? I'm curious, how do you see this?
Is there any perspective that you are looking at? I'm not able to completely get the question clearly.
No, the question is, what is it that you think is probably the reason why agriculture, some of the fundamentals, like you said, right? You talk about segregated six fundamentals, right? And also the problems in the sector, they seem to be also perennial in some sense. Right? The kind of problems we talk about. And I'm just curious, why do you, in your experience, from your vantage point, why do you think some of these problems, like we still talk about credit to farmers, right from the days when the first British Commission report came in, which led to the, you know, in terms of it talked about the importance of credit and the PACS and all of that. Some of these fundamental problems in terms of giving credit or other problems, right? They still seem to persist for a very, very long time. So I'm just curious, from your vantage point, why do you think that these problems you have not been able to tackle?
Well, there are two elements, right? One is your man-made policy related, and one another set is nature-driven. I think nature-driven things that it is beyond your control and my control. and we just have to evolve with the nature. Okay. You have to find technical solution, technological solutions to kind of go with the nature changes, right? That is, I don't think there's any argument there, neither you cannot do anything about it. And the next one is the man-designed, man-made, man-designed issues, right? That's what I put it.
Yeah, I like the way you're framing it, yeah.
So on the man-made issues now, well, there are two elements here, right? One is probably lack of knowledge at that point of time on the consequences of doing certain things, right? Mm-hmm. Whether you're using fertilizers, whether you're chemicals. I don't know, at that point of time, there was a knowledge, the consequences of it. I think over a period of time only they came to realize that. If he had known, probably it would not have done that, right? But what is the problem is, there was a point of time when you come to know, but not able to act on that aggressively, that is what I call is lack of determination to do it, right? Mm-hmm. That is where the issues come. We as, our responsibility for the society is to do that, whether you are a policymaker, whether you are an individual, whether you are a business person.
Mm.
I think you need to be acting on those things, right? And clearly on those things, whether it is a credit issue, whether it is environment degradation issue, whether it is certain areas, certain things that you are not supposed to do, you continue to do that, and usage of usage of goods, right? I think these are some things which we need to act, right?
Mm.
And of course, you always have the fear of what would happen if I stop this, right?
Mm.
Whether the consequences are so dramatic that I will not be able to manage the society, right?
Mm.
I mean, it's always that fear. But having said those things, but do you have a choice certain times, right?
Mm.
If you do not have a choice, at some point of time, you are going to act.
Yeah,
and if that is the, what is the case, then if you're able to promulgate some regulations on decisive drivers to get an outcome, like today, what is happening with the carbon reduction? I mean, carbon reduction is not something which is today. It was probably a decade and a half discussion, right?
Yeah.
And then today, all of a sudden, everybody wants to act. Why you could not do 10 years back? The same thing as an example, right? It is purely a failure of the individuals, whether it is the individuals can be defined anybody, whether it is businesses have a responsibility, the regulators have a responsibility, the policymakers have a responsibility. As on top of all this, now I always blame the consumers. Okay, say whether farmer will produce. Many times we start blaming the farmer. Why is he producing this? Why is he not producing this? Why? What is he doing this? Why are you doing that? If consumers demand, that's what farmer will produce.
Yeah, purely demand.
Somebody saying the other day, why cauliflower has got so many pesticides? Why cauliflower is like this and all? Why you are preparing this? I said that, why are you consuming cauliflower in the off-season? Right? And you are forcing the farmer to produce in the off-season, continuously have a demand. Right? What will you do? Because you are forcing him, he is also forced. I think consumers have a significant role to play in making some of these changes, in my opinion, honestly speaking, right? Because farmers have always been my friends. I am very biased towards them. They're always my friends because I like them very much. But having said those things, no, many times we blame them. It is not appropriate on some other
things. Yeah. I think it's
responsible, right?
Yeah, and we have to also take ownership as consumers, as people who consume food, and as as somebody who set the demand also in motion, demand gears.
Exactly.
You
consume the vegetables which are the right for the season, and you can see you'll get very good quality vegetables.
Absolutely. I think. I mean, I really like the way you put it in terms of at some level we have to take the decision, and there is a fear that comes in there, right? In terms of not wanting to take the plunge and not wanting to see if what happens if I pull the plug out.
Right.
That kind of a determination, as you put it, I think is there. So probably, I think on that note, thank you. It was really inspiring for me to hear your very refreshing perspectives in terms of the seeing that is the market dynamics. Although we could have gone into much more lot of aspects there, but I really wanted to focus this conversation on your journey. really, you know, I'm fascinated by what some of the aspects that you talked about today, and I think a lot of peer listeners who tuned in also would find it valuable. And I hope somebody, probably some of the founders who are working in the upstream space, might also reach out to you for for either for investment or for advisory per se, perhaps. Thank you very much, Subbarao Garu, for joining us from this podcast, and I'm really looking forward to staying in touch. Thank you.
Thank you, Venki. It's a pleasure talking to you today evening. I think I hope some of the listeners, if they want to reach me at any time, I think my email and mobile should be accessible. I'll pass it on to you.
Sure.
And also, anyone who would like to speak to me, just call me. Anything that is bothering you, anything that I can help in any way or connect with some people, I'd be more than happy to do that. I think post-retirement, I decided that I want to help people. It's very simple.
Wonderful. Right? I'm very glad. Today, the one reason why I really reached out to you was also like today, I work with a lot of agritech entrepreneurs and founders. And most of them are young, early stage companies, right, who are trying to solve pressing problems and at the same time cash trapped and, you know, struggling with various aspects, you know, in terms of staying business, keeping the business afloat, right? So I think they could really do a lot with guidance from people who have really gone through this pathway in a longer period of time and can give them perspectives that can really help them focus on the fundamentals. So I think I'm really glad that you're also open, and I will definitely pass on the connections wherever I can, and thank you very, very much for speaking to us.
So you're disconnecting now?
Yeah, one second. Okay.